dear mommy. You know as well as anyone that I've seen my share of wars. There was the time you bailed my ass out of the Chechen situation in 97. That other time, me and you and a few hired hands stole Jew gold from Nazi bankers, only to spend it all on quarts of Mackinac Island fudge ice cream bouncy balls and rope made of North Koreans' hair. And of course, you know all about my exploitations in the forests in Indonesia, because you listen to the All Caps podcast loyally, as do millions of others. Those were good times compared to this. This is hell on earth. I arrived in Guatemala 3 weeks ago, but I had no idea what sort of shit-fucked cockstorm I'd be dropping into. The second I hit the ground, I learned I was given a field commission for two reasons. One, I looked really sexy parachuting in, thanks to that sleek jumpsuit you got me for Bottle Rocket Day. And they also liked that I had no fear when equipping my chute with a boombox, blasting Tesla's five-man acoustic jam. Two, the highest rank around here was a corporal, but his face became goo pretty quickly when he forgot to duck a 50 cal bullet, something I was taught to do to the point that it's almost instinctual. Ducking bullets, I can do that. I can also rip the lower mandible off any fanged beast from here to the coast. I've been doing it whenever we have some downtime. Anyway, they quickly named me Commanding Rear Admiral General and briefed me about the fight. Our enemy is an elite force of Oprah Winfrey fanatics who lease land from the Chiquita Banana Corporation. They're heavily armed and completely brainwashed. These cackling, middle-aged wrens are constantly going crazy over Oprah giveaways and emit a sort of high-pitched premenopausal guffaw that sends shivers down your spine. I'm told this is being called the War of Zach Anner, and that we're fighting to get that cripple his own TV show. A just cause if I ever seen one. Not like dying on a lie in Iraq. No, this is God's work. Except here, there is no God. Only brown people, rainforest, mosquitoes, and, of course, bananas. Shit. BRB, have to give orders.
Ramirez, Gutierrez, Rodriguez, Martinez, Chavez, Lopez, Hernandez, Mendez, Perez, Fernandez, Alvarez, Gomez, Flores, Diaz, Topaz, Morales, Valdez, Vasquez, Torres, Smoke, Malibu, Black Guy, Hatchback, Laugh Track, Knucklecrack, Peace Pipe, the warrior formerly known as the Compound Word, Hans Gruber, Navajo, Uncle Frump, Baby Bump, Mons Mass Von Dickway, set up a perimeter, stat! I want all eyes on the bush. No one dies tonight, you hear me? Not on my watch. Tonight, we avenge Nunez, Reyes, Benitez, Rojas, Contreras, Cardenas, Jimenez, Vinigas, Benigans, Shenanigans, Zep, Brannigan, Dar Dragonfall, Dragon Dargonfall, Last Call with Carson Daly, and Keister.
Okay, back. Sorry, if I don't give these men destinies, they'll start scraping their own shit for corn kernels. I'm on the first chopper home in the morning. My first order of business is to fuck, but my second order of business will be to reclaim my seat on the All Caps podcast. In the meantime, give my love to Scrip Scrap, Lil Shaver, and Duncan. Oh, and Reginald Belfry, too, that fuckface. Fondly, Chris. P.S. If I don't make it through the night, tell Tanner you can have my ACR collection and my extensive collection of dinosaur trading cards. There's also a squaw tied up in my basement. Tell her her personal trail of tears is almost over.
What the fuck was that?
What the fuck?
You're listening to the All Caps Podcast, episode 45 for the week of Monday, July 19th, 2010. In this episode, we discuss barrel drinks, Burple, Westboro Baptist Church, protesting Comic-Con, fleshlights on Neptune, vagina science, Sarlacc pit, an Italian three-year-old prodigy, Zubily Zoo, a kit in the freezer at Bass Pro Shop, Inception, team sports, floor hockey, blow-up planetariums, being fast, girls chasing guys, and a whole lot more. For more information, please visit www.allcapspodcast.com.
I believe it was yesterday. I was called to the bathroom at the cemetery to take care of something. I walked in the bathroom, and in the middle toilet right there, somebody didn't shit in the toilet, somebody shat on the toilet, they shat on the walls, they shat on the floor. I had to clean it up, man, but before that, for about 10 to 15 seconds, man, I just stared at somebody's shit, man. to be totally honest with you, man, it was a really, really profound moment. So I was thinking, I'm 30 years old, and in about 10 seconds, I gotta start cleaning up somebody's shit, man.
I guess your weekly source for news, politics, culture, all varieties. I'm Tanner Higgin, podcasting out of a desert in Southern California.
And I'm Commanding Rear General Admiral General Chris View, podcasting out of Detroit, sir.
It's nice to see that you came back in one piece. It was looking a bit grim there.
Well,
wow.
There were a lot of dark moments, let me tell you. There's a lot of times when you're out in the bush like that and you just think to yourself, this is it. This is where it ends, with me and a brown lady screaming. I mean, just fanatically, just going crazy. And then you think to yourself, it's either her or me. And I've got a podcast to come back to. What does she have in her life? Nothing. Except Oprah, maybe. But so yeah, I mean, there's a lot of dark days, and believe me, on those nights I really wish that I could hear the All Caps podcast. But let me be the first to say that Squid was a very adept and almost as good as I am as a co-host of the I'm just kidding. She was good, actually. I really was entertained by that. And it's always great to have a girl's perspective on shit, because it can be a boys' club sometimes. And
and also what was most enlightening is we happen to be pop culture aficionados on a level that very few other people approach. And it was interesting seeing someone that isn't steeped in pop culture like we are. And I've learned that a lot of times we make these references without any thought to the fact perhaps 80% of the audience has no idea what Empty Nest is.
There were a few times I almost started to write them down, because there were a few times where I was like, oh, I would have totally said this, you know, like to something you said, but then the reference, you know. But there is this, because I think there's a lot of people our age or above who can't hang with us. I mean, there's times where I'm talking to people who are like 4 years, 5 years older than us, and I'm referencing shows that they should have grown up with, and they don't know a thing about it, or music that they never heard. And it's odd to me. So I think this is sort of the quagmire you and I live in, which is, you know, 2 years younger than us is hard to identify with. 4 years older than us, you're either with us or you're totally against us, you know, at this point. That's sort of where we live.
Our pop culture minds don't match our bodies. We should each be about 350 pounds, right. You know, and in one of those bubbles, one of those plastic bubbles, or some kind of motorized scooter.
Yeah, we should be like Mother Brain, you know. See, and that's another reference. How many people got that? Raise your hand.
Metroid, everyone. All right, so let's hit the community wild card. So last week we did the first ever love-hate duel.
Which was awesome. That's a great idea, by the way. I really love that.
And one of the topics that drew the most attention was these, and this was one of the things that Squid didn't understand. Of course, she's also Californian, so I haven't seen them out here at all. You said you saw them in Tucson.
Yeah, if you're talking about the barrel drinks, those are so integral to my 1980s youth AYSO soccer mindset. You know, it's like when Casey and I saw those just before our road trip, it was like both of us, we had this epiphany, like, oh my god, do you remember this shit? And and I was really happy though to hear that Squid did remember Squeeze-Its, because that is that's sort of like the evolution. That's like the you know, that's like the Australopithecine level of the evolution of juice drinks.
And you know what makes a really good drink, and I'm starting to realize this, is not the taste, is not the, you know, the marketing, it's the way you get to the juice. Like, the barrel drink has this awful tinfoil cap that EA Henson on the forum under the community wild card,
you know, mentioned how it was very difficult to get a perfect pole and rip that foil off perfectly, and the rich kid, the rich kids would bring straws and just poke them through.
Those fuckers.
But if you think about Squeeze-Its too, Squeeze-Its were like the hand grenade of juice boxes because
they look
you'd pull that cap, that pin, and then just squeeze it in your mouth.
Yeah, and I mean, basically, it was just like a what do you call those freeze pops or whatever those things are. That's all it was, and it was like thawed out easy freeze pops, I think, is what they're called. You know what I'm talking about? Those like long, very
Hate them.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I only like them when it gets to the end because you get the juice, which is kind of why I didn't mind the barrel drink. But now that we're talking about different types of drink. Do you remember Burple? Because this is another...
Oh, my God!
I just thought of this, and because you were talking about the delivery mechanism, the way in which you imbibe the drink, and...
Neurons are being activated, and pathways are being rediscovered that have been left dormant since 1989.
Yeah, fucking Burple is one of the, because it was marketed on multiple levels for kids. It was both the excitement of the the shape of the object was nothing until you decided to unveil the full Burple capacity, which was by some NASA technology straight off the space shuttle. You would lift the cap and pull from the bottom, you know, put one hand grasping the bottom and then one hand on the cap, and you would lift up, and it would unfold into this large, I guess, you can't even call it a juice box. It was just this large number two plastic recyclable being, and I think didn't you have to add something to it, or was it? Yeah, I think you had to add, like, water, but then once it was done, you had a juice drink. And you also had hours of fun making burping noises as you went
They look like those plungers. So there's like the standard plunger, and then there's the plunger that has, you know, accordion-like shape.
Yeah, like three rings of functionality.
I imagine that Burple, after it inevitably crumbled, you know, the Burple Empire crumbled, and Lloyd Meriwether Burple II was sent into poverty. That they used all of the, you know, empty Burple containers that they had built at their manufacturing facility in Indiana, and then just got bought out by a plunger making company, and that's what innovated those plungers.
Wow. Okay. Well, really quickly, I just want to bring this up because I have found the wiki for Burple, and it says this. It's a very short one, so if anyone out there likes to fuck with wikis, you could probably do this very easily. I know when I went out to see friend of the show Casey out in Tucson, he's a teacher, second grade school teacher. So this gives you an idea of the mentality of our friends. He, in his summer vacation time, one of his, I think this is awesome. He tries to find obscure Wikipedia entries and then alter them just slightly with things that may or may not be factual, but would be hard to prove. You know? It's the coolest idea ever, and I watched him at work on one, and you know, he hits the there's like a randomizer on Wikipedia where you can just hit a button, it'll randomly shoot you to an entry, and he's very calculating. Like, he'll look at the history and like, oh, okay, this one wasn't updated since like 2008, so no one's gonna see when I add this tidbit of info. And sometimes it can be as stupid as, you know, like a scientist that no one's ever heard of, but it'll just say, he'll just type something like, you know, about the scientist's sexual escapades or something, but like not in a very overt way, but just in a way that sort of leaves it open to interpretation and perhaps further research by someone who is an expert in that field who gives no shits about Wikipedia, by the way. So anyway, okay, sorry. Burple is a discontinued drink mix that was packaged in an expandable accordion-like plastic container. There were two sizes of Burple available, a lunchbox size, which was key, by the way, for kids, and a full-size container. To prepare the drink, the container was stretched to expand to its full size, and water was added to the concentrated liquid in the bottle. The drink was often compared to Kool-Aid and came in the flavors grape, strawberry, cherry, and orange. The label included instructions for poking a hole in the cap to convert the container into an ad hoc squirt gun after finishing the drink.
What?
I never knew that.
That's horrible idea, by the way, because there would be dye remnants.
Not to mention spittle all within it. You're shooting toxic materials at other kids' eyes. It's like, hey, kids, here's a squirt gun, but the prerequisites for shooting it is you got to spit in it about 1,000 times, get your germs all in it. Then we got to make sure that we got all kinds of dye and all kinds of powder and shit that can make your eyes really burn and crusty.
Fun fact, between the years of, I'm reading here, between the years of 1985 and 1988, Burple was, and the Burple squirt gun more particularly, were responsible for 43% of all chicken pox cases.
I love that it's responsible for the most common childhood disease ever.
and 3% of all cases of molestation.
Wow. So I want a Burple just to test out the molestation claims. I want to try it. I wonder if at age 29 I'd get molested. All right, anyway.
Yeah, let's move on to the news. Remember to participate in the community wildcard every week. There's some more funny stuff on there, so check it out! News!
News, news, news.
The motherfucking news!
Wait! Okay, hold on. See, I was trying to add a little bit of legitimacy here, and wait my turn as I played the music in my brain, which is what you did on the last two podcasts without me, yet you still...
You're just so intense about it. Like, I could tell this time you were really trying because you had blown it the past four times.
Well, you blew it for me this time, goddammit. Oh, I'm so close. All right. This just in, Westboro Baptist Church is going to be protesting the fucking Comic-Con. Can you believe this shit? I mean, we've made it. If you're protested by the Westboro Baptist Church, either you're a war hero... Or in some way you're affiliated with something that should never be protested, or apparently now you're a nerd.
What are they choosing? There's so much to choose from.
Okay, well, here's what they say on their website, and this is a quote. Okay, so let's see if this ruminates with anyone out there. Quote: "Are you kidding? If these people would spend even some of the energy that they spend on these comic books, reading the Bible, well, no high hopes here. They've turned comic book characters into idols, and worship them they do. Isaiah 2:8, quoth."
I love the little Yoda turn of phrase there.
"Worship them they do."
"Isaiah 2:8, and I quoth, their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made." I'm totally lost. But then it goes to verse 9, which says, "And the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbleth himself. Therefore, forgive them not. It is time to put away the silly vanities and turn to God like you mean it. The destruction of this nation is imminent, so start calling on Batman and Superman now. See if they can pull you from the mess that you have created with all your silly idolatry." That's a quote from their website, by the way. I did not make that up.
Who wrote that? The Crypt Keeper? It sounds like... I love that any official correspondence... is coming from a deeply respected source when it begins with, "Are you kidding me?" Yes, a press release coming out of Westboro, Kentucky, wherever the fuck they're from the Baptist Church, reads, "Are you kidding me?" Question mark, exclamation point.
The best part about it, though, is that I don't know where the Isaiah 2:8 quote begins and ends. It's like, it's as though God actually said, "So start calling on Batman and Superman." You know, like God is so threatened by Batman and Superman. He's like, oh shit, fucking yeah, call on him, let's see what happens. I don't know, I mean, they'll fucking kick my ass, but I mean, I'm not gonna say shit, right? Anyway, I mean, that's how I feel when I read this correspondence from these douchebags, which I say douchebags, and then I look to the right, and the ad the ad on the website, clearly clearly not from the Westboro Baptist Church, but Summer's Eve Douche is the Google ad.
I wonder what computational logics are at play there, that they, but it's like, well, you know, people who love God have smelly pussies.
That's a fact.
The ad wizards at Google, they've created that algorithm.
So that was basically all I had to say. It's just funny that they find the most like benign and, I mean, really, these, I can almost guarantee you that at least 30% of the nerds going to the comic book convention at least think Jesus might have existed. Right? I mean, 30%, that's a pretty liberal figure, I'd say. But most of them only are concerned of whether or not a furry will be there that they can fap to. But are you going this year?
Yeah, on this Thursday. So there will be an official All Caps Podcast report from Comic-Con.
Do us a favor. If you can bring your camera, try to take pictures. If you find Reverend Phelps and all of his minions, even the children, like, try to get a pic with them. If it requires you acting like you are anti-comic, I think it would be worth it just to have it. So.
All right.
All right. All right. The next, let's see, the next one. All right. UFOs in China cause flight delays. This coming out of Chongqing, China. I didn't make that up. Two recent UFO sightings have caused a stir in eastern China with, quote, twinkling lights, end quote, causing an airport to shut down temporarily. The lights were observed above the terminal of Hangzhou's Shaoxian Airport. This is so legitimate. Do you hear how I read the news? This is fucking incredible. I should be on NPR right now.
And I'm looking at the news story. I think that is an accurate reading of that, too.
You're goddamn right. And it's a cold reading, too. So please, if you want me to read for NPR, my my resume is on LinkedIn right now. Okay. Let's see. Hangzhou's Shaoxian Airport on the evening of July 7th, causing 18 flights to be delayed or redirected. China's official Xinhua news agency reported, adding that the lights may have come from a private aircraft. Okay, so China, the official China view on this is that it might not be aliens, but the airport is a little bit skeptical about that. They said a source told China Daily the lights could have been caused by a military operation. On Thursday, a second UFO was seen above Chongqing, with one witness saying four, quote, lantern-like objects forming a diamond shape, end quote, floating above a park for about an hour, Shanghai Daily reported. Quote, I stared at it, and it did not move, another witness said.
Quote, and then finished his rice.
After hovering for an hour, the thing started to fly higher and finally out of people's sight, end quote. I that wasn't me reading that. I said end quote, but that was an actual Chinaman saying those words. I have this weird capability to completely delegitimize this podcast. Okay. Officials are trying to determine if the unidentified objects were private or military craft, rocket flares, reflections, or something else altogether. Now, this brings forth the question, Tanner, is there other life forms in the universe?
Certainly.
Now, do they have the ability to visit our planet?
No.
Exactly. That's my point. I'm serious about this, though. This is an argument I feel like I have, at least on a biannual basis. And it's one of those things where, like, I'm challenged by, oftentimes, incredibly enough, it's by people who are, like, either atheist or agnostic. But, like, they ask me, okay, you don't believe in God? I say, yeah, you know, I don't believe there is a God at all. They're like, well, do you believe in other life in the universe? I say, yeah, of course. You know, the odds are so outstandingly great that there's at least something, even if it's a paracetam. I don't give a fuck. It's still there. And then paramecium is what I meant. I don't know what I meant by paracetam. And then, inevitably, though, they try to sort of like say that there's this loophole in physics that allows these aliens to go above and beyond what humans can achieve. And that's when I stop, because I really don't believe, unless you can totally pull a fucking Event Horizon-esque scenario where you fold space and time, go through the wormhole, and then let space-time unfold to allow you to be so fucking far away from the initial point of entry. That's the only way I can perceive space ever being explored, because we are, as humans, limited to light speed, which is what, 186,000 miles per second? Is that right?
Yeah, it's not jack shit, you know, when you look at the size of the universe.
Yeah, and humans can't travel at light speed. So, I mean, I think our closest star is like 4.2 light years, right? Is that right? Something like that. And, I mean, someone can correct me on that. This is just me trying to recall from 12th grade astronomy with Jim Conney. But, either way, it's like when I hear people talk about the idea of space travel, I'm okay with it. But like, I really do think our limitations right now are our solar system. And I don't think, and maybe this is naive, but I seriously don't think that within the existence of at least Homo sapiens, maybe there will be an X-Men-like genetic, you know, sort of transformation and will become an altogether new beast. But for us right now, there is no way we could ever transcend the speed of light to travel places. So we are confined to missions, possibly to maybe Neptune, but it would require the dedication of someone who, at the age of 10, says, I will now dedicate all of my life to traveling one way to Neptune. You know, it's,
and they would have to be of the constitution of that guy who cut his arm off when he was.
Yeah. Oh, God.
You need to get those. How would you even evaluate people to find out, you know, if you're that dude?
If you would have caught me at 10 years old, I would have been like, yeah, I'll go. And then right about now, I'd be going, hey, what the fuck? You know, I'd be going crazy right now. So, because you have to. Here are the provisions that need to be on that spaceship. They have to accommodate future technologies, I feel. So we have to be very prescient in what we equip the spaceship for. Because, you know, imagine debarking from Earth now, and all you have for the next 50 years of your life is the accommodations we know now. So, like, maybe we give you a fleshlight. But, like, you know...
a stamina training for us fleshlights.
Yeah.
So you have a challenge.
Yeah. You know, we can give you a pocket pussy, okay? But 50 years from now, we're all going to have, you know, robo blows, which give you, you know, a very concrete blowjob off of...
I love the idea of this, you know, world-famous, courageous astronaut landing on Neptune and, you know, doing the kind of press junkets and various, you know, webcam reports to elementary schools. And just off the frame in the background, you see his stamina training flashlight as he's talking to a group of 8-year-olds.
But see, at that time, 8-year-olds will already have... See, because by the time he reaches Neptune, it will be like 50 years in the future. So everyone else is sort of laughing at this guy because they're like, dude, we all have... You know, we have free sex with fucking robot broads and, you know, everyone is issued one at age 10, as a sex... sex prevention technique. And my point being, you will leave Earth with no accommodations for the future. So we have to actually be very prescient in what we...
So, but then what kind of fleshlight do you want to bring?
Well,
what sort of fleshlights will there be in the future?
Well, what scientists are considering right now is the evolution of the vagina. And so what we need... What we really need to have
prickly barbs like Sarlacc's pit in Return of the Jedi.
Exactly. If you're looking at the cutting edge of science, not just the shit that you see in National Geographic and what you read on Discovery Online and shit, this is the stuff that's like, we're way down in the ditches of science. And these motherfuckers are trying to figure out they're trying to figure out what's a pussy gonna be like in 50 years. Pussy ain't gonna be like it is today, I can guarantee you that.
We gotta come up with prevention techniques when vaginas develop teeth to prevent rapings. We need to get past that stuff or raping's done with.
And in the future, men are gonna like teeth on their balls and their dicks. So we have to anticipate the liking of things that we hate now. I don't know. It's so fucking dumb. My whole point is that I think interstellar travel is fine, but like it really, in all seriousness, imagine if you were to leave Earth now, knowing that it's a one-way trip, you're gonna die out on, you know, one of the moons of fucking Jupiter, and you know there is no coming back. You'll be dead before then, unless we master cryogenics. It's really a very far off idea. Traveling to Mars, yeah, makes sense. I think we could do it, but like beyond that, it really requires a one-way dedication to death. So, agree or disagree? Come on, there's silence here. What's going on?
I agree. I mean, I think I have more faith in potential, you know, the event horizon potential. Ways to manipulate space and time dimensionally, I think.
It would be amazing.
I think it is possible, and I think it will eventually happen, but, you know, it'll take an immense amount of time.
Yeah.
That kind of science to develop, I think.
Yeah, and money, which unfortunately, you know, in this day and age, it's like, unless we, this is my last thought on it, unless we become more like the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek universe, where all pursuits are dedicated to science and, you know, that's sort of held highly above all things. And of course, in that world, you know, humanity has united in the common cause of space travel. Unless that happens, it's really going to be a hard road.
How are we going to even travel to Neptune when we can't get evolution taught in Texas?
Right. Exactly. And that's exactly my point. It's like, you know, until we all recognize that, okay, you know, in fact, with space travel, there doesn't need to be a belief or non-belief in God. You just have to believe whether or not we can dedicate money and resources to space travel. And I'm willing to do it. I have no problem with it. And ideally, the ultimate outcome of it would be that people who don't believe in God suddenly realize, holy shit, this is way more massive, way more intense, way more descriptive than the Bible ever was about anything. And that they would suddenly come to the realization that, okay, I might be able to believe in a God, but this whole Bible limitation, it's way too restricting. And so we can all come to that common ground of saying, maybe there is and maybe there isn't, but we can at least try to go where no man has gone before. That's poignant shit. I didn't write that though. G. Roddenberry. All right. In other news though, and this might actually play into the next stage in human evolution. In Pisa, Italy, Italian doctors say they're amazed by a 3-year-old prodigy who reads newspapers, operates the family's television remote, and even gives medical advice. The parents from the town...
Really? Medical advice that's really fucking stupid.
Hey, Mom, I think you should maybe take aspirin and linguine.
for your pancreatic cancer. Yeah, thanks, son.
Oh, look at the little Luigi. He gave us a little bit of scientific advice. He's only 3 years old.
Let me know how good that that Italian was. I'll put that on my resume when I go for my next acting gig. You can do that in the forums. The parents from the town of Perignano near Pisa say the boy named Ettore taught himself almost all these skills
just by observing adults. Which is funny to me because that's how all babies learn all skills, just by observing adults. So this is not fucking newsworthy.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, dumb shits, your kid is like every other three-year-old on the planet. How did they convince this? How did they convince this journalist to report on this?
That's a good question. That's because journalists are usually fucking retarded. But this is why it's stupid. Okay, let me finish it up. Quote, we started teaching him the alphabet for fun. That should never, first off, that's not for fun. That's for purpose. You teach a kid the alphabet for purpose, because if it was just for fun, that's like saying literacy, just for laughs. You know, it's not. It's for fucking utilitarian needs, you dumbasses. We would never have imagined his abilities would develop like this, Ettore's father, Francesco Grillo, a 44-year-old artist, said. Quote, then, when he was about two, he started to read newspapers and TV guides, Grillo said. This just in, I was reading the TV guide at about 2 years old, but I was saying it in my own words, okay?
you were looking for Empty Nest. The premiere of Empty Nest.
Yeah, I was like, what is it, Birdman? Give it to me. I want more. He's on Zoobly Zoo, too? I have to see.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Who knows Zoobly Zoo? Go to the forums right now.
Now that I think about it, he was cast.
A bird.
He was cast on Zoobly Zoo because of his beakish-like maw.
He was a fucking bird on Zoobly Zoo. He was the head bird.
Fucking Richard Mulligan.
Is he dead yet?
No.
When will it happen? When?
He lives,
what will it be of?
He lives, and I believe he's in a Central American country, and he's worshipped like that guy in Temple of Doom. You know, Onnamshibara. He's removing people's hearts in their chests. That's what Mulligan's doing.
You know what would be the most ironic death ever for him? Avian flu.
Let's make that happen, people. Richard Mulligan, beakish actor, dies at the age of 85 from avian flu.
A predictably bird-like disease that only inflicts bird-like people. All right, it says, initially we thought he memorized phrases and repeated them parrot-like, but then we realized he was reading for real. Local medical experts say they are impressed. I love local medical experts who are not named.
Yeah.
Quote, usually learning to read is a process that takes place at a much later stage at school age, and it's a gradual process, says Dr. Amerigo Celadroni, head of the local hospital's pediatric clinic. Ettore has even acquired know-how of medical matters, his father says. Okay, this is where the dubious claim begins, everyone. His father says he has acquired the know-how of medical matters, and this is the know-how. Here we go. Quote, one day, I was talking to my wife about a health problem I had, Grillo said, which, of course, is not... How great would it be if that health problem was like, I've got dick cancer.
Yeah, it's erectile dysfunction.
It said, quote, Ettore heard and recommended a medicine. I checked up and saw it was right in front of my case. That's it. That's his fucking medical knowledge. The father looked it up. This kid probably said, a gurgle, gurgle, blah, blah, blah. And the guy was like, wait, what was that? Arugula? And then he looked online and there was a fucking herbal remedy for his fucking case of scurvy. God damn it. I hate this shit. All right, that's that.
I hate people thinking their babies are geniuses.
It needs to end. Listen,
when your baby's a genius, you'll know because it'll look like the baby in Baby Geniuses, the hit film.
Yeah, it will have it will know how to put product in its hair to spike it. It will know how to buy glasses without you taking it to the fucking optometrist. That's when your baby is a genius. All right. Let's see here. God damn it. Okay, there's two more stories, but I'm going to consolidate one real quick. Good news, everyone. Vaccine will protect everyone against every type of flu. Okay, there's that one. Next is...
clearly the three-year-old giving medical advice. which makes this so clearly exposes how pointless this fucking story is, you know?
Yeah, but the reality is that scientists are saying that there is a universal flu vaccine that will protect against different strains of the flu virus that will be available within the next few years. We'll see what happens. I'm not going to read the whole story because it's all... See, within the scientific world, journalism really attaches a lot of caveats and like, well, we don't know. The scientist says that. But then when it comes to baby geniuses, it just takes it at face value, which is unfortunate. So when it comes to this flu vaccine, we may or may not have it, but check back in with us in 2 years if we're still alive. And, you know, maybe we'll all be immune to the flu. We'll see.
Well, what's most exciting is the new kinds of flu this vaccine will spawn.
I love that they don't address that in the story, by the way. I just closed it, so I can't read any further. But they do not say how this will affect the evolution of the flu strain, which is, I think, integral to the idea of combating flu. That's the whole reason why every year we guess at what type of flu we're going to fucking go up against, you know? So either way, we can combat different strains, but the fact is humans cannot ever beat virus. Like, viruses and bacteria will always outlive us, so we're done for. They evolve, they mutate quicker than we ever can. All right, last but certainly not least, Bass Pro Shops employee fired after putting kitten in freezer. This should hit close to home, Tanner, because you love cats. For me, this is a good news story, but whatever. An employee of Bass Pro Shops at Discover Mills has been fired after putting a sick or dead kitten. Did I just hear a kitten in the background, by the way?
The cat that I have locked outside of the door, immediately upon you starting this story, began crying outside.
That's incredible.
And I'm not even joking.
Yeah, I just heard it for the first time just now. Okay. An employee at Discover Mills put a sick or dead kitten in the store's freezer after a coworker of the female employee found the kitten frozen and lifeless over $2,500. This is the big tragedy. Over $2,500 worth of ice cream had to be thrown out because of a fucking cat. I mean, ice cream shouldn't be wasted, people. If anything, we need to have a ice cream humane society set up. Bass Pro Shops national spokesman Larry Whiteley, which is the most racist name ever, said three kittens were found behind the store in June, two of which were healthy and taken home by employees. The third kitten, which was not healthy, was placed in the store's freezer. But the employee's motive is still under investigation. Quote, "We don't know if the kitten died before it was placed in the freezer or if it died in there," Whiteley said. But there is no blame being passed on to Bass Pro Shops. The employee was fired shortly after the kitten was found. Animal Control and Gwinnett Police are investigating the incident. Gwinnett Police spokesman Brian Kelly said, quote, "If the investigation does prove any criminal wrongdoing on the employee's part, then certainly charges will be brought against him." So, what's your stance on kittens being placed on freezers?
Well, that's a hard-hitting question. What amazes me most about this is someone had to just go in the freezer at Bass Pro Shops, open it up, and see a fucking kitten in there. Like,
I want to know.
Your mind would implode.
But would it be acceptable if it was put in a Ziploc bag? Because those are meant for freezers. I mean, what that tells me is the employee took the hassle. They were like, look, man, this thing, it's not going to make it. So let's throw some fucking Ziploc around it. We'll tie it up and we're all set. See, and then they dated it
very conscientiously. Just in case you like your kitten meat only, you know, 3 months old.
The best thing ever, though, would be if it was labeled like Ted Williams' head or like Walt Disney, you know, something that's been frozen for real. Or to be used as tea, which would confuse anyone. I would steep that shit right away. All right. I'm done with the news. This is fucking stupid.
All right, we'll be back with Inception. In the culture vulture world, I only like real friends.
action remains uncontested. I think that movie ruined
our opinions.
That album dropped like poo.
God will be our word.
That writer's such a douche.
Culture vulture birds.
George Lucas fucked my youth.
Back with our culture segment, which is an extra special culture segment, because I think both mine and your most anticipated movie of the summer came out this weekend, which is Christopher Nolan's Inception, written and directed by Christopher Nolan of Memento, The Prestige, Insomnia, Dark Knight, Batman Begins fame. Lot of anticipation about this film because, you know, Christopher Nolan was on our radar with Memento.
Oh, yeah, big time.
But really, with The Dark Knight, he was launched into a sort of stratosphere of directors that few people obtain this kind of power, in that Christopher Nolan essentially has Warner Brothers Studio by the balls.
Yeah.
He's kind of like in a Steven Spielberg-like position now, where he can do whatever he wants, can request whatever money he wants and actors, and do anything that he wants. Like the Superman movies coming out, they're like, they just threw it to him. They're like, figure it out. and that is a lot of power. And this movie is special in that after The Dark Knight, he decided he was going to do an original property in a way. So it was really exciting because it was, here's his opportunity. He has all the resources he can get. He can do whatever he wants. This is what he's going to want to do. And, oh my God, it's not, you know, made from a book or a comic or something. It's just pure invention. So Inception stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, from one of Chris's favorite shows, Third Rock from the Sun.
I love me some John Lithgow and Big Dyke Broad and Judd Stewart with the squinty eyes.
That movie was almost designed from the set design to the writing to the casting choices to offend me on a visceral level.
You mean the TV show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ellen Page is in it from Juno fame. Ken Watanabe, Cillian Murphy, or Cillian Murphy, I guess.
I always say it's Cillian. And fucking Lucas Haas, by the way.
Yeah, Lucas.
Which,
from, I don't know. I haven't seen him since.
Mars Attacks was
Mars
the last
Attacks.
Time I saw him.
Mars Attacks, yeah. I mean, there's Tom Berenger is in the movie.
Awesome casting choice.
Yeah.
I love Tom Berenger. I do.
So Inception is an interesting kind of plot summary because ostensibly, and in all the promotional material, it is a thriller, a kind of mind-bending thriller about some dudes who go into people's brains and steal ideas. But that isn't what the movie's about. And let's try and avoid spoilers, but I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the movie is not really about stealing ideas, but it's about planting one. That's the idea of Inception, planting an idea in someone's brain, and it's considered by these guys to be a really dangerous undertaking. So it explores the mind and dreams, and I would put it in the genre of thriller or kind of mystery action oriented. I think that about covers it. So, Chris, what did you think about Inception?
Well, here's the thing with that movie. It is the great thing about this movie, it is that it ostracizes about 98% of the American viewing audience by being super fucking intelligent and exclusive to people who can follow a movie that is well thought out. The script for this movie is on par with Back to the Future, even though they're two totally different types of movies. You know, the script for Back to the Future is one of the best written scripts of all time. This, I seriously think, is one of the best scripts I've ever seen put to film in my entire life. It is.
Which, you know, if you're going to make that claim, is all the more impressive because Christopher Nolan is a director.
Yeah, that's what I love about this movie. There's so much to chew on with this movie. If you have a chance, just before you go see the movie, well, actually, you know what? Do this after you see the movie. Go to the website. There are a million different things you can do on this website, it feels like, including like designing your own poster, you know, bullshit like that. But there is a comic that is sort of a prequel to the movie. And I think my suggestion is read the comic after you've seen the movie, because it sort of contextualizes where the movie begins. And I don't know if you've done that at all, Tanner, or not, but
I specifically avoided it. And by the way, I also want to point out that I guess Christopher Nolan has been involved in writing every movie he's made.
Yeah. Well, him and his brother. His brother has been integral in the Batman series. I know that much.
And his brother is actually, it's rumored that he's going to direct Superman.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I'm excited. Let me just lay it out there. Okay, this movie for me, A. Straight up A. This is probably the best movie I've seen in a few years, and it is.
But so flawless. Wait. Better than The Dark Knight. Better than Star Trek.
Different than both of those. See, it's hard to compare. It really is hard to compare because those movies are good in their own right. But this is altogether. You know, I really do feel like it's going to take. There's going to be a lot of people who see this and they go, yeah, you know, I didn't understand part of it, but it's all right, you know. But then I feel like there's those of us who get it, and it's not hard to get, but it just takes that little bit. And I'm serious when I say this small infinitesimal amount of investment in what's going on, and then you'll get it. Because I've read a few people who are just like, well, you know, it's a bit too complex or whatever. But it's like, no. In fact, Christopher Nolan is amazing with his dialogue in that through the dialogue, he's able to explain the multi-layered storyline he's created without making it, hey, dumbass, hit you over the head. This is what it's about. You know, there's so many tiers to this story. Again, as you said, it's this dream sort of manipulation, and there's multiple layers of dreams that are unveiled, including, you know, all the way down to this limbo phase that is like the hardest to dig yourself out of, sort of, so to speak. And yet, you know, with the utmost care, I feel like Christopher Nolan has taken all of the pretense and bullshit posturing out of it and made it accessible to everyone. Every single person, as dumb as it can be, every single person, or as dumb as they can be, I should say. Every single person can grasp this movie. It just takes that little bit of time if you're dumb. If you're not dumb, you'll get it from the get-go. You're all set. But
yeah, I also noticed in the reviews this trend of people saying that it was too convoluted. And I had the exact same reaction as you, where because I pay attention when I watch a movie and I don't just expect it to be, you know, explosions and predictable kind of mysteries or whatever, I could follow along perfectly. And I was actually marveling at the fact that I knew precisely within such a seemingly complicated scheme, I knew precisely what was happening, what they were doing, what the stakes were, what the different levels were, why one was slower than the other. I knew everything that was going on. And even while the movie was the beginning of the movie is a little bit mysterious, while in the middle of the movie, I was understanding what the beginning was about. It all falls into place. And it's very clear that Nolan was very attentive to world building in this movie and building a world that has a kind of logic and system to it, I think that you can criticize that in a way, and that it's kind of missing some magic. You know, think about it in terms of this is a sort of midichlorian understanding of the Force rather than the original series understanding of the Force, in that there's really no magic here. It's trying to be more scientific and clinical. But in a way, that allows you to follow the plot better, I think.
Right. I think so, too. And I think what was great actually was actually being in a theater full of people who I immediately, like my first thought is everyone I'm seeing this movie with, except for maybe whoever's with it with me, is an imbecile. You know, when I saw this movie, at least like the way it ends, which I won't spoil at all, people had a reaction to it, which tells me that they were able to follow it. Because
yeah, the same thing happened in my theater at the ending. There was an audible oh
yeah, exactly,
which is surprising. I don't know that I've ever experienced that in a film. I do have I love the film too, but I do have criticisms of it.
Okay, and I wanted to list see yours because I have a few too, but go ahead.
First of all, and this is, I love Leonardo DiCaprio. I know a lot of people hate him. I think he's really skilled, and he clearly tries. Like, when he's in a movie, he's always giving it his best. And there's a lot of actors that don't do that, Nicolas Cage. But the combination of him and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, they're supposed to be these ultimate badasses with this long history of this kind of occupation. They're little shavers. You know, they don't hold this sort of gravity that other, like Ken Watanabe, when he's on the screen, he has a gravity to him. But they don't.
See, I think I disagree with that. I was very much enthralled with the whole sort of how do these two work with one another? Because clearly that's the cool thing about this movie too. Everyone has a very distinguishable role. No one is stepping on another person's ground in a sense. I mean, yes, you know, you can argue that Leo sort of does, his character does, by not informing his team about certain things about his dreams and his mind and whatever. But see, my favorite character, I have to say, I don't think I would ever, in my wildest dreams, I would have never said this, but my favorite character in the film was Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He was my favorite. And it was because he's the point man. It's like you've got the A team in front of you, you know, and he's the guy.
Someone did a really good job of describing this film and saying that it's essentially a heist.
Yeah, exactly. It's a memory heist I don't want to give anything, it's this sort of dream heist. And I really loved Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character. And it was because it was very minimalist yet effective. And I thought that his rapport with Leo DiCaprio's character was perfect in the sense that Leo was a little bit, you know, he's by the book yet still secretly unhinged. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is very much like, he is by the book. Things should happen this way. This is how, you know, it's hard to explain this because there's so many levels and layers to the film. But for his character, you know, he is there to sort of ground Leo in the work. And Leo is like the proactive. He's like the offense of the entire show. And then Joseph is there.
So you didn't, I mean, I'm just kind of surprised because the whole time it was kind of taking me out of the movie, and that I was thinking these guys just don't, I'm just not buying that they are as good as they say they are. And let me make a counterpoint here in that, you know, I thought Ken Watanabe was great. Everyone really put on a great performance, but in particular, this guy, Tom Hardy, who was in a movie that I've been wanting to see that's been on my Netflix queue called Bronson.
Is he that Sean Bean lookalike guy? Sort of.
Yeah, he plays Ames.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
That guy is a fucking star, man. Like, when he's on screen, he's just like, he has this power and this understated kind of command. And he's so subtle and awesome. I can't wait to see that guy in more movies. And I guess he's playing Mad Max.
No. Yeah. Oh, that's a perfect role for him, too.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about him. The other complaint I have with it is it really hinges on the trauma over a love story. And the love story, to me, I understand why it had this sort of kind of spookiness to it and a really hard edge, like a threat to it. Like the, it's not this romantic kind of love story, that it has a knife edge to it.
Yeah.
But I liked that, but I just felt like the emotional resonance of it didn't quite get, I didn't feel it was sold to me correctly. And I think this is a problem with Christopher Nolan as a whole. I don't feel that he capably handles romantic relationships in any of his movies. I don't feel like he can quite get it. It's always a little bit cliche or removed from reality to me. I wasn't that invested in that aspect of the plot.
See, so Leo's love interest is his, in the movie, it's his wife, named Mal, played by Marion Cotillard, who is fucking gorgeous, but also really, see, I found her to be both captivating and at the same time, after what her character is established to be, she was captivating and ultimately scary to me. Like her presence in the dream world was almost like, you know, like playing Bloody Mary in front of your fucking.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was really scary. I didn't know what was going to happen with her. And I liked that. I liked that I was so unhinged when I was around her character. Yet Leo DiCaprio's character, Cobb, is semi in control of her, you know, like when she appears, everyone else gets fucking freaked out, but yet there's a resonance to his relationship with her, which is unfolded through the movie. And I won't spoil that, but like, I think she captured it well. She had to play two completely, the parts were just totally opposite of one another, where she's both his wife and his memory. And in both roles, she was beautiful and scary to me. So I think she nailed the part. Now, Leo,
I just don't you think that the film is missing like one scene where you see them connecting on some level?
Yes. I think Christopher Nolan's attempt at that connection was in the scene where where it's sort of a flashback to where they're going to celebrate their anniversary at the hotel that they always celebrated at, and yet she is in a certain state of mind. I hate this because I can't say much more. I don't want to spoil it, but like, I think that scene where she's sort of on the ledge and he's on the ledge of like their hotel rooms respectively across the street from one another, I think that was the attempt to establish that connectivity between them, because she was reaching out to his character and saying, come with me, we can be together forever. And he was trying to say, you know, no, because of what he had done. And I think that's sort of where.
But I'm talking more in like an everyday kind of context. Like, he has those classic Nolan flashbacks that are soundless. Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to have been taken to one of those scenes, build up that relationship a little more, and then still include that key climactic moment, which, yeah, by the way, Leonardo DiCaprio totally sells. And that's hard scene to sell.
Where it was incredible.
Because that scene could easily be really stupid. And yeah, you know, that his emotional outburst could read really wrongly, but he does a great job of it.
Well, and let me say too that I, for the first time, I think I really appreciated Ellen Page's performance on this movie.
She was all right. I mean, she did what she needed, but she'll always be Juno like that.
I know.
I can't get fucking Diablo Cody's awful writing out of my head.
But let me just say this. What I was most grateful for is the fact that there was no sexual tension presented between Ellen and anyone else.
Thank God.
That was so key, because if there was even if it was between her and Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, Arthur, it would have been, because there's a scene where he like kisses her, but it's to make the dream authentic, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
And even that, it was sort of cutesy, but yet it was very much practical. And so they don't follow it any further than that, and that's the end of it. And I
which,
was
Which is a sign of an adept director and writer, and a politically aware one, where the every woman in the film isn't focused on getting guys. You know, she's there for her reasons and for her talent. She's not there to be a love interest, you know, which most hack-ass directors and writers, every woman has to have some kind of romantic connection.
And her connection with Cobb, Leo's character, is very cerebral, very much like, okay, this could jeopardize the mission, which I liked. I liked the idea that she came into it. She was recommended by Michael Caine's character, Miles, who was like Leo DiCaprio's, I guess, stepfather, I think, in the film. And I like that she sort of stays that way. It's not that she's one-dimensional. She's very much a three-dimensional character. I mean, she is fully fleshed out as far as I'm concerned. But we don't have to get too deep into what she's about to know what she's about. And, you know, so if I have any complaints, here they are. Number one, I love Ken Watanabe, but there are times, not just in this movie, but in other ones that I've seen with him, where he's hard to understand when he's speaking English. And I hate to be, you know, that Walmart, you know, fucking crowd of people who's like, fucking speak it like we speak it. But there are times where what he says, at least when I saw it at the AMC that you used to work at, they have bad audio there, by the way.
Yeah, they do.
But I had a hard time sometimes. So I would be processing what his character Saito said. I would be processing it while other people are talking it, just so I can contextualize it, you know?
And, yeah, I think it's more that he has a, you know, it's not his English, it's more his pattern of speech. You know, he kind of has this weird way of pronouncing words, you know, kind of like an impediment almost, that's uniquely his. But I, you know, that's really more of an issue, I think, with Christopher Nolan should have just done more takes, because I can think of, there was a couple times where I didn't know what he had said either.
Yeah, it makes it hard. And then, okay, so the second criticism I have, and this is just purely, you know, I mean, I don't think there was extra scenes written for this or anything, but I love Pete Postlethwaite. I think he's one of the best actors that's out there.
Yeah, and
I really do.
His fucking face. He doesn't even need to do anything. His face just sells whatever he's doing.
And he was featured in, I think, two scenes total. And so he plays the father of Cillian Murphy's character. And he's shown, you know, once, I think, in the real world and then once again in the dream world. And what as poignant and as effective as he is in the dream world, part of me just wanted more of Pete. I love that fucking guy. Everything about him. And then let me think. The last criticism, let me think. It's not something I experienced, but actually Katie experienced it. We both went and saw this together. And it was that during the last sequence where they're in, because it's multi-layered, they go from dream into a dream into another dream, sort of like multi-layered dreams. The last one, they're in that snow level, if you want to make it like a video game reference. They're in the snow level.
Which I made a post on my personal website, TannerHiggin.com, about the comparisons between this movie and a video game. I'm interested if anyone can come up with any more. I made a list of them, and that was one of them. That there's levels in this film.
Yeah, and I love that. But see, for me, I was very much so interested in it that it was okay. But when they get to the snow level, I can sort of see Katie's case in that the guy that we like, what's his name? Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy, yeah.
Who plays Eames. When they get to that level, everyone's sort of wearing like snow masks and they're faceless. And he goes off to sort of lead away the bad guys. And for whatever reason, there was a hiccup in the movie for her and she missed his whole diversion tactics. And so she didn't understand why there was combat going on. And meanwhile, like Ken Watanabe's character and Cillian Murphy are trying to like hack into this safe and all this other shit. And she thought it was just cutting back to action for action's sake.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so, And I talked to my brother today about it, and he sort of saw that too, where if you missed like a key point where he's sort of like, I'll take care of this, then you could easily be duped into thinking that there's just this action going on in the snow and there's no reason or rationale behind it.
Which it's great to see both Katie and your brother getting pissed at that, because most people are just like, fuck yeah, like more shooting. You know, like I love to see people like, what is the reason behind this shooting?
Yeah. And I sort of had to explain it in the context, which is impossible. Unless you've seen the movie, what I'm going to say now makes no sense. In the context of like Cillian Murphy needs that sort of like in his brain, it needs to be credible. This is a dream, but it's also a manufactured dream. And in the meantime, there are so many safeguards in place to combat this sort of forced intrusion into the dream that, you know, there has to be bad guys and there has to be a way to get them away from the place where Cillian Murphy is going to have his deep sort of reconciliation moment and realization moment. And so, you know, Tom Hardy as Eames serves merely as a device to divert all of the bad guys away from that so that this realization can happen. Now, of course, there's certain things thrown in there that sort of derail this plan, but the plan is executed nonetheless because Tom Hardy is unaware of what's happening inside of this snow palace, you know? So, again, as I'm speaking this, I'm thinking no one knows what the fuck I'm saying unless you've seen the movie. So you have to see the movie to really experience what it is that I'm talking about.
And the reality is this summer is one of the worst summers of film in recent memory. Everyone agrees. There's no doubt about it. It's an awful, awful summer for film. So if you're going to see one movie this summer, this is probably the one to see. I give it an A-.
I give it a solid A.
Can't wait for the Blu-ray, and I demand Christopher Nolan make a movie with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh my God, how amazing would that be?
All right,
and
let's do it. Let's move on to Wild Card. The Wild Card segment, weekly recurring rotating games, humorless in nature, that we like to play and like you to play along with on the allcapspodcast.com community forum. This week we are back with Time Trial, where one of us or both of us, this week one of us, comes up with a topic unknown to the other person, throws it on the table, and then we have a set 10 furious minutes to talk about that topic and let it take us wherever it may take us. So this week, Chris came up with a topic. What is that topic?
This week's topic is team sports.
Clock set!
All right. Well, I mean, I would almost want to hear your perspective first, because I was heavily involved in team sports in high school, in the fact that I was co-captain of the Utica High School swim team, which makes me super buff, super tough, super rough. But but I'm actually more curious about team sports when we were kids, because there's what prompted me to think of this is the fact that today Katie and I were cleaning house and we're trying to do a garage sale, and I found two trophies, one from when I was in AYSO soccer.
Why do you still have them is the question.
Don't ask me. Every time the chopping block has come up, they've been saved, apparently.
Oh, and why?
So I have one from that, and then I have two from Little League when I played Little League baseball. So what was your experience? First, let's not even talk about organized team sports. Let's just talk about team sports when you were a kid. Like, you're at fucking Latchkey and you got to play basketball, or you're playing fucking dodgeball, or whatever it is, Foursquare, you know, that dumbass game you play on the playground where you throw a ball into a
fucking and that was such
cone.
That was such a pitiful attempt by you know, the designers of school playgrounds and schools themselves, where they're like, oh, we'll make this blacktop fun by painting on this stupid-ass set of blocks you're supposed to jump on. No one ever used those, ever. But ever. My experience with team sports is whenever I played organized sports where I was forced to interact with other kids, I fucking hated it. Because, just like today, I hate other people. But I would play sports all the time on my street in a rotating season-based set of sports, you know, the baseball in the summer, you know, basketball, and it all rotated around, and I loved it then. But I gave soccer a try, I gave football a try, and I gave hockey a try. Each one I lasted one season. Even at my youngest of ages, I would sit there and look around at the people I was with and just loathe all of them, because sports were always a chance for dickhead kids to be even more dickish.
Yeah,
I don't know if that was your experience. Like, that competitive atmosphere was carte blanche for them to let out all of their rage and anger.
Well, one of my greatest memories, and I might have already articulated this in an earlier podcast, but for those who are just now joining us, one of my best memories is back in junior high, we were playing floor hockey, which was highly anticipated.
Oh, hockey was the pinnacle of all gym sports.
Yeah, I mean, you seriously waded through like, oh, we're playing fucking badminton. Okay, we're playing volleyball. And then all of a sudden,
one of the games that ostensibly was supposed to be fun but ended up not being fun at all was where you'd get the big parachute out and put balls in the middle.
Well, that's elementary school, yeah.
But what was the point of that game?
Well, okay, if you did it right, see, we didn't actually put balls in the middle. We would just move it around, and then you would take the parachute, lift it up over your head, and then sort of pull it behind you. And the whole point of the game was you would go underneath the parachute, as in the center, the air congregates, makes a conical shape, and then it slowly comes down on top of you. That was the point of that game. The point of that game was
even dumber.
But it was fun when you're a fucking kid. It's like climbing into the fucking what is that called? Not an astronomatorium, but
planetarium.
Planetarium.
So you had those two. Did you ever have that where they would bring a planetarium into your gym and you'd crawl? It was like a colon. Yeah, it was an igloo with a giant colon, and you'd crawl into the colon and essentially go up into the stomach.
Yeah, and everyone would lay down and put their hands behind their heads like you were stargazing. But meanwhile, you're in this big inflatable colon. Yeah, you're right. It's like the modern golf/soccer. I don't know if you guys have that out there because you guys.
There was one on like 10 Mile and Van Dyke. We called the Sports Maggot.
Yeah. Yeah. They're everywhere around here. When the weather gets either too hot or too cold, they'll inflate a sports maggot and people will go into them to perform either soccer or whatever is off season yet can be made in season by inflating this huge dome. And, but see, for me, I loved that fucking planetarium. You'd go in. It was just like building a fort, but it was already built for you.
Yeah.
Which is great.
The reason why floor hockey was the most anticipated was because precisely what I was arguing, that it allowed kids to be even more dickish.
Yeah.
Because you suddenly it's like, all right, here's some weapons.
Yeah. Well, but above all other sports, even football, I would say, playing floor hockey was seriously like, it was, if you were in what was considered like an uncool portion of the school population, if you were an all-star on the floor hockey team, you were at least sort of like elevated to, you would be chatted about by cool kids who sucked more than you. So, or you would be targeted and then ostensibly whipped like I was. But, you know, it was a defining moment for kids. If you played floor hockey and you did it well, especially because I often found that the kids who thought they were the coolest thought they were either a forward or a goalie. So if you could beat the goalie, you were a badass.
Most floor hockey games would devolve that I played
right
in gym, and it would just turn into a series of slap shots. Like kids would anticipate the puck touching their stick so much that when it finally did touch their stick, it would just instantly end in a slap shot.
Like, no matter where you were, it was a one-timer opportunity.
And did you play? There was two tiers of floor hockey. One was with these giant foam sticks.
Yes, I played that. But then there was the plastic sticks that you could actually curve yourself.
You would eventually get upgraded to those, which no kid should have ever got. We were not mature enough to get upgraded.
Not at all. Not at all. No, but so like with floor hockey, this is incredible, by the way, because in junior high, I feel like junior high focused more on those sort of intramural sports activities than I ever had in elementary or high school. I mean, we were playing like softball. I remember listening to the first Weezer album and being out on the softball diamond with Mark Kayla, if you remember that kid. If you remember, he was pitching and he would get pissed when you could get a hit off of him. But I was singing like the sweater song in my mind as I was going to first base and destroying his pitches. Shit like that.
Yeah, I remember softball.
Yeah, but even like because in elementary school there was a focus on team sports, and in fact there was a summer program, or maybe it was an after school program, that was called team sports, but it was far from being a team sport. It was always like, hey, who's great at this sport? Oh, you played outside of school, you're the team leader. Now everyone else is sort of subordinate to you. Okay, we all pass to you and you score.
It was really, I mean, sports at a young age is really just beating you into what your life will eventually be down the road, where you get bullied into shit at work, and one person does everything, and everyone else just hangs about.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, there was never a team sport that required me to publicly speak, because I would have destroyed it. I would have totally dominated a public speaking team sport, but there's no talking when you're playing hockey. There's just yelling and telling people to get into position and shit. And so I lost all the time. But
the bad news for all those people who are awesome at sports is, number one, after the age of 13, no one gives a shit that you're fast anymore.
Right.
Like, when you're a kid on the playground, being fast is equivalent to being the Flash in a superhero comic. Like, that is a skill people want to see you do and want to challenge you doing it. But then after the age of 13, you never run fast ever again.
Yeah, I haven't been challenged since third grade. And technically, what it earns you is like pre-pussy rights to all girls. Like, no, like there's no sex between you and the girls, but they love it if you're good at that sort of shit, you know?
Did you have that phenomenon where girls that liked you would chase you around?
Big time. Always. And
which is so fucking bizarre.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious when you think about it. When I was in elementary school, friend of the show, Eric, can verify this. We were chased, me, him, and this other kid were chased exclusively by, I don't know, maybe six or seven broads who loved us. I mean, they worshipped the ground we walked on. We were amazing. And this is pre-puberty, so I can attest to my amazingness. Once I hit puberty, I became a monster. But before that, when I was my prepubescent self, I looked amazing, and all girls wanted to chase me. Of course,
you had the body Adonis. You looked like one of those statues you see at any classical museum.
Exactly. I mean,
including the acorn-sized penis.
Yeah. I was, you know, I was ahead of my time. I was stage two pubescent with pubes at stage two
pre pizza face.
Yeah. No pimples had yet touched my
all
face.
All back knee hidden by your rude dog t-shirt.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All back
knee. Little did those girls know what they were chasing. If only you slipped through a wormhole and revealed your future self.
You know what's funny? Wait, okay, let's bring this up to them. Because acne is like, I think it's weird, because if you talk to kids, it feels like kids today, or well, kids our age faced acne as this big disease that our parents never, ever had to encounter. When I talked to my mom and dad, I was like, where did I get this shit from? And they were like, well, I don't know. I mean, we had it for like 3 months. It was like chicken pox. It was like, yeah, I had it for a month, and then, you know, it was cured. That was the end
of
it.
Yeah, but once in a while, you'll see an old-timer with the battle scars.
That's true.
God only knows. Whenever I see someone with those really awful scars, I pour a little bit of my old English 40 out, because I can't even imagine what it was like. By the way, yes. The 10 minutes are up.
No! What? We barely even scratched the surface of this. Oh my god.
That is All Caps Podcast for this week. Go to allcapspodcast.com. Go to the forum to participate in the Queenie Wildcard. It's linked on allcapspodcast.com. Go to iTunes. Post a written review. Shop at the t-shirt store. Do all of that shit. We'll be back next week. Now don't get all worked up. Things would be different if you were in my place. This argument would change. Feel like I'm in second grade. She really meant nothing. I was a drunken idiot. And now I'm full of shame. We've all been there before, and every time we both run for the door, you just threw all my clothes off the third floor. This is so fucked up. Well, I don't know why this whole thing's on my shoulders. Let's let it slide and watch it blow over. You can't keep searching, there's nothing to hide.